Ladies and gentlemen, the boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Budapest, Hungary. Welcome back to Deliver It. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan. I finally had success. I've been trying to bake bagels for 3 weekends in a row. And finally, I had something that wasn't a complete abject failure. So I was very happy about doing that in my newly remodeled kitchen. I'm very excited today because I have a guest. She is a fellow product geek who loves to talk about products all over the place. She's one of the co-founders of Mind the Product, which is an extensive product management community. And she's also the CEO of ProdPad, which is software that helps product managers plan and deliver better products. And she's also an evolving artist. Please welcome Jana Basto. Hi, Jana.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on here today. Great to be here.
So I have been following Mind the Product for a while. I've been following ProdPad for a while. I've never got to use ProdPad, but I've been a big fan of Mind the Product and a big fan of how you talk about roadmaps and everything else on Twitter and LinkedIn and all over the place. So it's great to have you here.
Wonderful. Great.
A couple things. So Jana's here to talk about our main topic. First, a couple things that I read the last couple of weeks that I think product folks should read. The first is from Russell Olson, who has an article called Shipped is Only the Beginning, the 10-10-10 Approach to Product Rollouts. I like this because one of the things that we always talk about with delivering software is at the end or at the end of some point or at the end of an iteration or something like that. And we always think about it, or most people think about it as it's 100%. You deliver everything you've got. And I like this approach because if you're dealing with millions of customers or lots of customers, probably pushing out to all your users immediately isn't the right thing to do. And he's got a really good approach, which is push it to 10 customers first. No matter how many users you have, 10, and track those 10. Those 10 should be friendly, or those 10 should be things that you know about, but push it to 10 users, get them to use it for a while, a day, an hour, something like that. Get their feedback or get some feedback on how it's working with those 10 customers, then push it to 10% of your users. And that may be another day or another couple hours or something else. And then once you've validated that you've got all the things working, then you can push it to 10 times that, which is 100% of your users. So I like that as a conceptual thing to go, a small rollout, a little bit bigger rollout, wide rollout. Something that he talks about in his article is this really does give you time to monitor, learn, and educate people on each iteration. So if you have salespeople or marketing people or support people who want to know how this is going to work, you can help them see how that's working. And it also helps with your user adoption. So you can actually improve your organizational readiness by showing that we can handle each stage of this rollout. So the product's done, the story's done, the work is done. Now you need to get it to customers. You do a little bit at a time and see how that rolls out. So I like that approach. Jana, do you guys do something like that at ProdPad, or how do you guys roll out?
Yeah, actually, I love this. I love this article, and I love how he puts so much emphasis on what happens after things are launched. Because so many tools out there and so many processes are focused on that delivery slice of things that happen in the wider product development process, and not many teams really think about what happens before delivery or what happens after delivery. You know, developers say it's done, so you shoot out the door and it's done, and you don't really think about putting it out to the right people, telling the people who originally asked about it, closing that loop and making sure that they've actually heard about it and can see it, making sure that it's solving the problem that you originally hoped it would. And if it didn't, going back and taking the time to fix it. And if it's a mediocre launch, then rolling it back or doing something to fix it and you know, actually making sure that you are solving the problems that you hoped it would. Too often, the process is just much more about building something and getting it out the door, and you get that little check mark, right? You've hit your agile cadence,
right?
You've got your user stories out the door, and your burn down chart looks great, but it's not really focused on getting something actually launched into customers and solving actual problems for the business. So yeah, here at ProdPad, we very much focus on what happens after that launch as well. So we've got stages that look at the beta phase and, you know, the contacting customers phases and where you measure success and making sure that you've got explicit space for those things to happen. And that's baked into how we build things here at ProdPad internally, because we do launches every Wednesday. But also it's baked into the tool that we built. So we actually have a process that looks at what happens after development and explicitly gives you space to build out your process. So I can imagine teams actually using this to have a 10-10-10 set of stages after their done column for whatever development's done.
Yeah. That's something that I've seen a couple times. This is the reason I like this, because if you release it to 10 users and two of them have problems, you can stop, right? This continuous pipeline or continuous delivery pipeline or automation of deployments go. If you have that, if you have a problem with 10 users, you can stop. And that's really where the benefit for this is also. You can make sure that you've got it right or that you fix the thing before you go 10% of your users and then 100%. So it's a really good thing. There was another article that got real nerdy on me, and I kind of liked it, but then I felt like I was in the deep end, and I was going to get, I had to put on my scuba gear to go down there because I wanted to read through it. It's from David Harris, and it's about Bayesian product rankings at Wayfair. It gets really nerdy into the math of what Bayesian approaches look like and how those are calculated. The reason I thought this was interesting for product folks is because it's a way to identify, present, and select options when you have millions of them. So Wayfair obviously has a ton of information on their website, a ton of product information on their websites for people to go through and search. And they really wanted to find a way to put their most appealing products at the top of each page so that people could go and look at it, whether that was a new thing or an older thing. The approach that they go through here is really about those statistical problems and how to update the random, seemingly random things that happen first with the new data that you've already acquired. So they are constantly tweaking this algorithm, tweaking what people see. They're A/B testing. They're doing all kinds of things to see which ones are more successful, I should say. And they're actually looking to influence behavior. So what did people, did they add this to the cart? Did they search it? Where was it in those rankings? Where was it in the site? How many people saw what? Is this a new item? Is it an old item? But really interesting ways to talk about how you, and this is applicable because if you're in an application or you're building a product and you have millions of searchable data points, this might be something you can use and say, how could we apply that to something on our site or something like that? So I frequently work with when you have, you know, hundreds or millions of customer information or contact information or products or reports or whatever you're working with, how could you find and select and search that that information a little bit better? And that's where I think this article comes into play. So, Jana, when you guys are, do you guys have any search algorithms or any kind of things like that in ProdPad that helps kind of users find information?
We have some interesting stuff happening with our own data stuff. Now, I'm not sure if it's using this Bayesian approach, but we have some interesting things that use natural language processing and word distance to figure out how different pieces of content are related. So instead of taking a look at what looks like Wayfair is doing here is finding how different products seem to be related and how they're similar. What we look at is how pieces of feedback might be similar and what sort of themes might come out of that, or how feedback might be related to ideas and help make suggestions there. So not sure as to how this might be related to this sort of ranking that they've got, but we sort of have some interesting maths going on with how we surface stuff within our own system. And it comes up in search as well. So if you try to search something, it will find the fuzzy match based on, you know, word distance similarity stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you try to add a similar idea, it'll sort of say, hey, you've been here and you've done this, you've kind of done this path before and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I always find it really interesting seeing the really smart stuff that you can do once you've actually got usage and once you've started seeing this pattern and once you've got data in an account versus what's happening when you've got a fresh, fresh product and no data and nothing to work with.
Mm-hmm. Really good information about kind of searching and finding and presenting lots of information for better access.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
So Jana's here because we're going to talk about organizational alignment, which is, we've touched on it. I've touched on it a little bit, but with product organizations and everything else. But I think this is a good topic we can get real nerdy on and try to kind of pinpoint some of the things that are problematic, some of the areas where people think they've got alignment, but they really don't. And then some ideas around how to get better alignment. And Jana, you had a really good article that was talking about alignment, shared that out for folks. But what is it, the problem that you see more often than not with organizational alignment?
Well, I mean, more often than not, organizations often think that they have alignment, but they simply don't. You know, they've sort of stated their what their product is, and they've sort of let people off in, they've created their teams, but they haven't actually explicitly got that alignment, and they haven't created the space for the team to actually go and do something with that. And so you get a lot of teams who are actually just operating in various levels of chaos. You know, so it seems simple, like make sure everybody's pointing in the same direction, make sure everybody is working on the same stuff, make sure everybody understands what good looks like, make sure everybody understands what successful means to them. But it's actually really difficult to pin down and make sure that everybody is in fact on the same page and working in the right direction.
Yeah, that pointed in the same direction thing is something I think that's really big, because you see it so often where the executives are pointed in one direction, the middle managers are pointed in a different direction, and the teams are pointed in a completely different direction, or at least how they operate. And they're not really talking about the same things at the same time. And that's really bad, because then you get into arguments and status calls and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, a favorite game that you can play, not a game, but a little test that you can do is go around the team and start asking people, you know, what is the product vision? Mm-hmm. And just sort of get a sense as to how people describe what the company is actually trying to do. And if they all come up with different things, if they all pitch what the company, like why the company exists differently to you, then you know that everyone's pointing in slightly different directions. Mm-hmm. You know, ask different teams how they think that they're actually being measured. Ask two people on the same team how they think they're being measured. And they'll often come up with completely different things. And it's often because the story is being told in different ways at different times, and different things get latched on to it in different ways. And it just, in order to get that organizational alignment, you need a strong, consistent story. You need a that consistency of that message. And it needs to be something that is aligned with how the team is structured as well, so the team actually has the organization within themselves and the space to actually do something about it and work towards it.
Yeah. And there's lots of, usually when I see alignment, I see, at least in the Agile and the Lean context, you see autonomy kind of paired with it.
Yeah.
That we're aligned and we're autonomous. And there was a really good a bit of information that teams with high autonomy but poor alignment find themselves building stuff that doesn't solve the real customer problems.
Yeah. And so you see this often in startups, right, where you get teams who are very flat organizational structure and everyone is an expert in their own domain. But oftentimes, and they often have a lot of free space to go work on things. They don't have some boss sitting there telling them how many widgets to go build and when, but they often end up running off in different directions because they each have their own little lens on what problems might be out there, and they all have the ability to go solve problems, and so they run off and solve problems. And that might be fine when you've got a team of like five people, mm-hmm. because chances are they're talking to each other and there's only so many nodes of communication.
Right.
And so they're going to be more or less pointing in the same direction, right? Even if they go off in different directions, it's kind of, they're still going to pull each other more or less in the same direction. But as that grows, right, that becomes 10 people and 20 people and 100 people, just becomes pure chaos. It becomes really difficult and you get people just pulling apart in completely different directions, and you just end up building randomness, and it's ineffective.
Yeah.
One of the ways that I like to think about it is, you know, you've got this old way of managing, and it goes back to the manufacturing lines, where you've got this boss who's micromanaging people and trying to tell everyone essentially like which widgets to make and by when and how many widgets to make. And, you know, this is fine for manufacturing lines because it's just helping to make more efficient the value creation, because you know how many widgets you need to make, and you know that they are tied to the creation of value for the business, right? For each widget that you make, you can sell it for X, and that's fine if you know that that's what the business is actually trying to do. Mm-hmm. But it's really limiting when the value creation needs to be tied to something more creative, when you don't know what the end product or end service is really meant to be. And so there's this new way that you can start thinking about things that a lot of companies have sort of passed by, because they tend to still work in this old school way of working, of micromanaging and trying to get people to do certain things in sort of this top-down way. But this newer way of thinking is, you know, take advantage of this army of knowledge workers that you've hired, right? Whether that's 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people who you have on your team, they're all knowledge workers. They've all been hired for their brains. Mm-hmm. And they're all smart. They're all creative. They all have different lenses on the world, different ways that they break down problems and understand them. Yeah. And so if you align them to the vision, they all understand what the vision is, and they all know what good looks like and what problems they could be solving for the business that would fundamentally help the business hit the right milestones and become more successful. And then you give them autonomy. You give them the space to go solve those problems. Like, you know, your team over here, you can go solve this how you think mm-hmm. suits you best. And your team over here, you can go solve that how you think suits you best. Give them the ways to go solve the problem on their own. This way of working is almost certainly going to solve those problems much better than a team who's told from above which problems or which things to go build and when. Because what you end up doing is limiting that creative potential. You end up with way more management overhead, and you end up missing opportunities. You end up building the wrong things because you end up limiting it to what one micromanaging middle manager can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Those opportunities, the problems that are there, you know, making sure that everybody's pointed in the same direction. Down from, and there's multiple levels that I typically see with this too, which is, you know, there's the team level alignment, there's the product level alignment, and there's the organizational level alignment. And that's the organization is not just your IT department. It's the company, the organization. Everybody has the same direction, the same type of aim. So team alignment, I think, is pretty common, pretty standard. We see that a lot. Aligning around products, you know, product strategies, product visions. If you're in a company that has multiple products, you will have multiple product visions and product strategies. Maybe you're an overall one as well. That organizational one is where I see a lot of breakdown, where the business has a different aligned, you know, the business and the technical sides are not aligned.
Yeah.
They both have different goals or different objectives that you're trying to hit.
Yeah. Well, this is where OKRs can be so powerful. Objectives mm-hmm. and key results, because what they're really designed to do is be cascading, right? They start at the very top of the business with a North Star objective, and then they cascade down. And so the team objectives should be something that stack up and help meet the overall company objectives. And overall, everything should feed into this overall North Star, but it should start from the top organizational level and feed down or cascade down for the rest of the team. So that alignment is something that should start from the top and be consistent across the board. And what they're really doing is that they give alignment, right? Those objectives and the key results help define what good looks like and essentially get everyone on the same page with what that good looks like, what they're being measured on, what success looks like for that business, and what it looks like at the team level for once it gets down to that level. And then they work really well in conjunction with roadmaps if done right. Because roadmapping gives autonomy, because a roadmap is essentially the initiatives or the things that are going to be done, the problems that are going to be solved that help meet those objectives and hit those key results, and are paired with the experiments that are designed that are going to be run in order to solve those problems or to help it hit those objectives. So essentially the roadmap is where the team says, okay, well, we can see that the overall problem is this. We are now going to design, let's say, 10 experiments. We're going to try to run the first 5 of them and see how well we can do. And by doing so, we're going to find the best way of solving this problem. And theoretically, by the end of this, we should see some impact on this overall OKR. And so it's giving them the space to do so. And it's using the roadmap as sort of a framework to give them both the alignment and the autonomy.
Yeah, the one telltale sign I see frequently is when you've got the roadmaps or the OKRs and they don't flow down to the different levels or up to the different levels. They have different, it's like they're completely different OKRs or different roadmaps at the different levels. They're just not aligned. They're not sharing the same information, I guess, is the best way to, the simplest way to put that is they're not similar at all.
Right.
They each have their own objectives. They each have their own things they're trying to do, or they're more strategic versus tactical or something like that. They change between those different levels. So I guess that's one of the signs you can look for is it should be shared across all those team, product, organization level.
Yeah. It's actually something that I call OKR drift. It's this whole thing that I see where teams get their OKRs set up, sometimes in some fancy tool, and they spend the first 2 weeks of the quarter just getting their OKRs set up and, you know, agreeing on all the KRs and all of the tooling and everything like that. And then they leave it there. And then they go off somewhere else and they go do their product work elsewhere. And hopefully that product work is iterative, right? They're learning, they're moving, they're hustling, they're shaking, they're doing stuff. And by the time they go back and check their OKRs, it's been hidden away in some tool that they haven't been looking at on a regular basis. And the work hasn't been informed by what the original OKRs were. And so the best thing to do is actually tie those two together, right? The roadmap should be created based on what the original OKRs are. And every time something happens on the roadmap, it should be reflected and updated in the KRs, right? You should be, the two should go hand in hand. One is a flip side of the other. And so ideally, you should have a roadmap that is an OKR tool as well. You know, be updating them on a regular basis, just as you would, you know, any other sort of weekly metric tracking and, you know, sort of iterative update thing that you would be doing.
I see it also where, I mean, OKRs, KPIs, the goals, I mean, we talk a lot about those or in product, you know, here's the things we're trying to do, here's things we're trying to accomplish. Just having those, and I know that when you talk to companies and you try to teach them to do it right, or you try to get them to do it right, there's so many groups that misuse those. Or they use them poorly. So I guess what we're saying is please do them right. Please do them better. Right is you know, questionable, but do them better, right? Have those goals, have those aligned to customer value, the KPIs, the OKRs, align them to customer value. It's okay to have business value in there too, but don't make it so that they're just focused on reducing costs or something like that. Those types of, make sure those are good OKRs. You know, see where the value chains are in those OKRs or those roadmaps, you know, don't focus so much on, I hate this term, resource optimization. Don't try to utilize your people to 120%. Don't split people across multiple projects or products or whatever. Those are bad things. I'm going to judge those as bad. I think most people would judge those as bad. But use them, use those tools, those roadmaps, those OKRs. Use them right.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree with that.
And I think there's lots of talks, and we'll put some links to the articles in the show notes. There's lots of ways to kind of go about getting that organizational alignment better, or at least fundamental. Maybe these are more fundamental things. And once you have these, then you can go on to do the OKRs and the roadmaps and everything else. But a lot of people talk about psychological safety as terms of alignment. We have to be able to ask questions and we have to be able to feel comfortable asking those questions and communicating with higher level people, lower level people. We have to talk about these things. And if we can't talk about it, then we're probably not going to be aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you mentioned psychological safety. So I see product culture, I see there's like a formula for product culture. It involves alignment plus autonomy, but take that and multiply that times psychological safety, because psychological safety is a multiplier on that, right? You know, bad psychological safety can have this net negative effect on your business if teams don't feel comfortable, people don't feel comfortable speaking up and reporting errors when they see them, or don't feel comfortable making bets if they don't feel comfortable championing the product and championing these goals that they see. And good psychological safety can be this huge multiplier. It can launch your products and launch your company further ahead than pretty much anything else that you can that you can do. You know, having people feel free to collaborate with each other and communicate and to talk about problems and therefore be able to solve problems is absolutely huge. Being able to break down silos and just feel comfortable having tough conversations and tackling the really difficult issues that that come up, because you know you can't just stand at the front of a quarter and just say, yes, the problems to solve are these, you know, the goals are this, everyone just go and expect the team to just run with it. Like, this stuff is hard stuff. The team is going to have to be prepared for that. And if your team is more mentally prepared for this, if they got that psychological safety, they will be able to handle what comes at them more readily than a team who doesn't have that.
Yeah. Another way that I see this falling down, and something that I've tried to do in organizations I've been part of, is make sure that everybody does have the same goals. If you have performance management systems in place, if you have incentive structures in place, they have to be the same, or they have to be pointed at the same things. You can't have a QA manager charged with doing something and a development manager charged with doing something else, your product manager charged with doing something else, because they're working at cross purposes. They're not aligned. They're working on different things for different reasons. So they have to share the same thing. They have different specializations, and that's okay, but they're all pointed at the same thing. And sometimes that takes some structural changes. That takes redoing how your organization is built to get that alignment, because they are operating in silos with that silo-based goals or silo-based mentality.
Yeah, it often helps to be able to create working groups around common goals. So not even necessarily changing the structure of the team. You don't have to go and, you know, switch up all your bosses and everything like that, your line management, but just allowing the creation of working groups around common goals can make a big difference. Giving people the freedom to, you know, tap somebody on the shoulder in a different team and not feel like they are imposing. Yeah. You know, it's a combination of just having that freedom to do so and the psychological safety that they, you know, that they're not imposing, that they're allowed to do so. You're on the same company, you're on the same team.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
Yeah. Well, you should be. You should treat each other like you're on the same team.
Yeah.
Several times you see that where that's not the case.
Yeah.
Something else I think is big for that alignment is everybody can see everything. It's visible. It's visible either on a wall or in a dashboard or app or something where everybody can see the same information. It's transparent. The teams can see what the executives are looking at. Executives can see kind of where the progression is at for the teams. You know, are we solving those problems? Have we solved those problems? What kind of information do we see? But all that information is out there. All that information is shared. And the most importantly, it's the same information no matter who's looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was actually one of the main reasons why I ended up building ProdPad, is because everyone sort of thought that product management was this black hole, you know, this black hole where ideas disappeared to die, and that I was just sitting here making decisions. So people would just give me ideas and I would just pick my favorites and build those ones.
Yeah.
And no one really understood what was going on in there. And it wasn't I wasn't saying no to ideas out of spite. I was having to say yes to a very select few number of things because they aligned with what the organizational goals were, but people couldn't see that. So by putting it somewhere and saying, actually, here's where you can see what the goals are, right? We're doing this because this idea, this experiment is going to likely get us revenue. And right now, revenue is important to us. So therefore, this is on the roadmap. And story your other ideas down here because it doesn't. You know, it takes the sting out, right? It helps you explain what's actually going on in there, because product managers aren't wizards, right? We're not magically coming up with stuff. You know, it's a framework of decisions that product managers have to do. And, you know, we shouldn't be doing it in a black box. We should be able to explain why one decision is being made over the other, and it shouldn't just disappear into some hole in the corner and then come back out and be like, ta-da, this is what we decided.
I now want to have the job title of product sorcerer.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
I don't care.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
But yeah, just make sure all those things are able to be seen. And something else that I focus a lot on, and I've been trying to read more about it and to get better at it, is the aspect of storytelling. because your alignment toward a thing, you need to be able to tell a really good story about that. It's not just that it's important, but tell why it's important. Tell it who it's important for. Give examples of it failing or examples of it succeeding. But tell that story to your organization, to your customers, to your team about why that thing's important and get better at that. I mean, it could be a story that you tell at a presentation. It could be a story you tell at a sprint review. It could be a story you tell at a sales conference or something like that. But that story about the big problems you're trying to solve, what you're aiming at and aiming to solve and why, be better at talking about that stuff. Not just writing it down. Writing it down is cool too, but be good at talking about that stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that's a great way of framing it.
And that's one of the reasons why I like watching and reading and all these things, because yes, I can figure out the framework, and yes, I can see your canvas, and yes, I can see all these other things, but tell me the really good story behind that. Tell me of a story of that being successful or failing, or of somebody learning that process. Those learning stories are really, really good too.
Yeah, absolutely. Because these are the types of things that help make sure that people remember it and it carries through to the different levels very well. Because otherwise it ends up getting communicated the once and ends up getting sort of stuck at various levels, and people don't, it doesn't get filtered through to the various levels, at the team or individual level. And you end up with people thinking they know what the vision is or thinking they know what the big picture is, and they don't, right? They end up pointing in a slightly different direction, and you end up with that chaos that we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah. And one of the nice things about working in an agile or a lean fashion is by design, you're coming back to that very often, right? Once you deliver something, you can come back and check, did it work? You go a couple iterations and are we on track? Are we trending towards what our goal is? And if we're not, let's do something about it now. Let's not wait until the end of the quarter or the end of the year and then talk about why we missed. Let's actually change something and do it now.
Yep, that absolutely makes sense.
And there's a really good article, a really good talk actually on Mind the Product from a couple years ago. And I won't pronounce the framework name because I can't. It's in German, but it's a really interesting framework about trying to find out. And he goes through and talks about that using this framework, this alignment framework, and that's why I specifically call it out here, is they got more clarity. They got a clear intent. But the interesting things that I really liked was less panic.
Right.
Imagine if you had less panic in your job. Imagine if you had less people yelling at you as a product person. Yeah. Less waste. You didn't do things that didn't make sense for the organization or for your customers. And they had more freedom to do that. That's where we get back into the autonomy. They actually were able to do a lot more things that they wanted to do and helped solve that real big business or customer problem. And that's why that alignment framework that I used was able to do that. So I'll share that. It's a long German word.
Oft.
Do you know how to pronounce it?
I can't pronounce it. I'll mess this one up. It was from Mark Kadish. It was the Oftrag Skralrung framework. Something
See,
like that.
That's why I didn't do that.
I'll give it a go. Yeah, that was a product tank talk, and it's up on Mind the Product.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very good. And it's one of the few alignment frameworks I've seen. I've seen lots of articles and talks about, you need to get alignment. Okay, great. How do I do that? What do I do that with? Yep. And this is a way to kind of frame that discussion and then see what you want to do. Again, to put on your OKRs, your KPIs, your TLAs, all those other things, three-letter acronyms, that you want to do to put on your roadmap to be able to get that organizational alignment. So I like that talk. It's really good talk. It's a really interesting framework. And it's something that I think will help folks at least start that process of trying to organize around the same thing. Anything else, Jenna, you can think about that? What are some of the key things to do or to go back and do often when it comes to organizational alignment?
A key thing is to check what you have right now. So, check that you have a vision statement and check that your team actually understands what it is. If you don't have that, then go back to the drawing board and make sure that you have that. start there and start building it out from there. Start with the basics and build from the top and cascade it outwards and downwards as needed. You might find that actually people in your team do have great alignment and are on the right path, in which case you've got less of a job in front of you. But you also might find that it's absolute chaos and you hadn't realized, in which case, start with the vision, make sure everyone's pointing in the right direction. They all know what that gold-topped mountain is in the distance. Make sure you yourself understand that and build out from there.
Okay, Jana, one of the things we do on the show for first-time guests is we always play a game called Three Questions. Are you ready?
All right, ready.
For your three questions. The first question is, what are three products you use and love in your personal life, and tell me why you love them?
Three products that I use and love in my personal life and why I love them. Cool, all right. So I'm loving the app Musician. It's an app.
Musician, okay.
It's an app for people who are learning how to play music. I've got it on my phone, and it's got a desktop for Windows. It's almost like Guitar Hero or Rock Band.
Yeah.
But you can you can learn like guitar or ukulele on it, which is what I'm doing, which is fun. So that's one. Oh, what else am I using in my personal life? You can see, you can't see, this is a podcast, but I've got all the plants in my background here. I've got another one called Plant Parenthood. And it's a great app because what it does.
Wow.
Yeah, what it does, it allows me to keep track of the plants that I have and when I'm supposed to water them and when I'm supposed to take care of them and all that, which is great because otherwise they would suffer. So it sort of pops up and reminds me of these things, which is good. What else am I using? I'm trying to think of things that I'm using for personal stuff. A lot of my things are blended, personal and work life.
It could be blended. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I mean, I'm trying to get along with Rome research. With Rome?
I never heard of that. Tell me about that.
It's the note-taking app.
Okay.
And allows you to sort of network your notes out together. And I've seen some really good things about it. It's good for taking notes. It's kind of like a good replacement for Evernote, which I ended up ditching. So I took on Rome. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of getting into the groove of it, but I haven't yet gotten to the point that I can sort of take this big stand back and see all my notes, all my brain network thoughts out, which is what it's apparently good for. So I'm not there yet, mm-hmm. but I'm starting to see the potential of it. So I'm going to give that one maybe another quarter or so and see how I get on.
Very interesting. Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Second question. Usually I ask about what's the second most amazing thing you've seen a product person do, product owner do. You talk to so many product people and kind of hear so many stories. What's one of your favorite stories that you don't talk about a lot?
Oof.
That you heard?
That's such a good question. I suppose I love talking about the product people who don't even know that they were product people. And I've got a few of them in mind, but I can actually think of quite a number of people who've ended up in this, because one of the things that I've done in my career here at Mind the Product is surrounded myself with product people, mm-hmm. but also people who are curious about product.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you run into people who realize that they've been doing product management this whole time and, haven't been compensated for it, haven't had the title, haven't had the hat, but have been doing it in many ways. I fell into product management in that way as well. I was sort of doing it and then, somebody came over and plopped the hat on me and told me I was a junior product manager.
Yep.
But one in particular comes to mind was the first person who was the convert, and she said, I think I'm a product manager. She came up to me after a particular event and said, I think I'm a product manager. We had to chat. I'm like, I think you're a product manager too.
Mm.
And she went back to her boss or to her company after this event and said something, talked over what she thought she was. And after that, she was given the hat. She was given the role. And she became a product manager, and she ended up writing a guest post about it on Mind the Product. So that sort of immortalized this transition into product. And since then, I've seen countless others sort of make that step into it, which is really great. So there's a lot of people.
They've got the mindset.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who have that mindset, who have this mixed bag of background. I talk to people all the time who are like, I have this background. It doesn't sound like it's a product manager. Does this still fit? I'm like, yeah, that's totally fine. I talked to somebody the other day who came from the background of a classical pianist. He's like, would I make a good product manager? I'm like, yeah, sure. Sure, it'll be fine. You know, because product managers fundamentally are the generalists who like to ask questions and like to get involved in things and generally don't get put into boxes very well. Right. And so, you know, if you're asking yourself, would I be a good product manager? Chances are that aptitude to ask that question is probably a sign that maybe you are.
I like that. Yeah. Okay. And the third question, what product ideas are you most excited about for the future?
Ooh, so many. So, I mean, one of the things that we did when we started Prodpad was that we knew that Prodpad was just going to be one of the products. You know, we'd be remiss to assume that it was the best product we could ever come up with, because it was quite literally the first one. It was just a tool that we were building to help us solve our own problems, because we were product managers. We needed tools to do our own job. But we actually formed the company under CreateShift. Right, CreateShift is a company that creates products to shift the way that the people work. And so we've got this wider remit, this wider vision. And now that we've grown up, we now have a wider team. We have time, we have space, and we have this wider vision. We've actually been spending time with this mini R&D space within our own company to build out some other interesting pieces. And so we've been playing around with things like trying to allow you to do things like search on your feedback and say, you know, here's all the things that my customers have said to me. Be able to search and say, what do my customers want the most from me? Or what do my customers from this region think about my product? Or what do, you know, my enterprise customers think? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what frustrates my customers the most? And it'll come back with answers. And that's all using AI type technology. So some really interesting stuff coming out of AI right now.
Very cool.
So we've got a mini prototype launching there, internal prototype launching in that space. We're going to be testing out this week. Really excited about how the business space in general is evolving, the consumerization of enterprise in general, because, you know, we've always had these high standards for what we expect from consumer tools. And so building that into our expectations for what we do for work, I think that's going to just continue ramping up and up and up to the point where work is going to be, you know, eventually actually usable and, you know, pleasant, hopefully.
What a concept.
Yeah. You know, where we actually have tools that work. you know, really interesting to see some of the leaps and bounds that have happened over the last 5-10 years, and looking forward to seeing what comes out of that in the next 5-10 years, and you know, we're going to play in that as well.
Very cool. All right, those are your three questions, Jana. Thank you very much for talking about those and organizational alignment.
Great.
For any feedback or questions about product ownership, contact the show on Twitter at Delivercast or email us at delivercast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. A couple questions that I saw this week. One was from Jocko, who asked about setting sprint goals within Kanban. Says, I work with a team that is more project-driven than Scrum. We work tickets that are mostly the same for our clients, just with different criteria. So we switched to a Kanban method of continuous delivery some time ago to remove those ceremonies, which really helped to reduce context switching. As the PO, I'd like to be able to set some goals for the squad, but I'm really struggling to find anything that will add value. Currently tracking metrics like time and status, monthly throughput, backlog size, new requests, et cetera. Any ideas? Okay, goals within Kanban. So Kanban is more flow-driven. It's more you know, how things come in. There's nothing to say you can't set a goal for a period of time. I still would like to do that. Like the next month or the next 2 weeks or whatever it is, we're going to be focused on this type of problem and set those goals just like you would any other kind of context. I don't think that's a problem at all. It might be difficult to find those meaningful goals. Maybe that's where you do some analysis of 60% of the items that came in the last month were on this particular type of problem. Let's see if we can fix that particular type of problem from occurring. We'd like to take it from 60% to 30% by doing this. Maybe that's something you can look at. Maybe if there's nothing specific like that, then yeah, maybe if you're tracking those things like your monthly throughput or your time and status, maybe a goal is to reduce that. And how do you do that? Well, you experiment. Maybe you reduce your WIP. Maybe you get an additional person to focus on this area. There's lots of ways you can try that, but I still would have some type of aim that you're looking at with your Kanban team even. And those can be short-term, they can be long-term, it doesn't really matter. But I definitely would try to put some goal in there for Kanban teams as well.
Yeah. Other things that I would think about when setting goals is to, a lot of these feel a little bit output-focused. And, you know, when you're tracking output, oftentimes you get to the end of it and you go, well, so what, right? So you've done a lot of things. Yeah. Right, you might have done a lot of story points, or you spent done a lot of tickets, or done whatever. But at the end of the day, so what? Does it actually mean that your company is any better, or the product is any better, or the customers are any happier, or whatever else? And so, anything that that you measure should be related to some sort of outcome or impact that it's going to have on the business itself. And so, I try to look at these in terms of, well, what's the outcome? What sort of outcome would these influence? And so that's another key thing of these, is that these aren't necessarily things that you you should be tracking things that you do. They're not things that you actively go and check off and go do, but they should be things that you influence. So it's not something that somebody would go and, you know, go and do their 5 tickets per week or number of new requests created or whatever else, because that can often be gamed, where somebody goes, well, yeah, I created 5 new requests, and it just says test or junk or whatever. But it should be something that people can influence by doing their job in the right way. That by influencing that, that should improve something about the business or about the team or about the potential impact that the team has for the business.
Yeah. I like the notion of behavior change too, which is what behavior are we looking to influence to change as a result of this goal being accomplished.
Yeah.
If we changed a good example for a support type team is if we reduced the amount of people that called in and used our online help, that would be a good impact because we have more information on the website, or they would be able to get to information quicker. They wouldn't have to wait, you know. 3 hours in a queue or something like that.
Yeah. And don't feel like you have to track everything. If it's not adding value to track it, don't.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes these things are just vanity metrics because they're tracked just because you happen to have that metric and because some tool has it or because somebody along the line thought, ooh, this is something that I can track. And then you spend a lot of time tracking things and you have all these numbers and it ends up drowning out the useful numbers and gives you this data fatigue. And you start missing things and you start, you know, having a lot of numbers to look at, but actually not making a lot of impact. So, you know, if your team actually doesn't need you to track all this stuff, then don't, you know, just track things that actually impact the business.
So hopefully there's some good information there, Jocko, for setting up goals in Kanban. Another question that I saw was from Lily, who asked a question about user story mapping and how to structure for different users. Says, as a newbie PO question here, how to structure the story map. Situation is the app is split into 2 sites. One's for the end user who does their thing. The other side is for the admin review where the users work, provides feedback. There's a setup and configuration, all that good stuff. If I try to create a narrative flow, then it would mean jumping between the admin and the end user perspective in the same horizontal line. Should I capture the flow separately for each perspective? For example, just the end user flow, one story map, and the admins in another? Please help me shape my mind around how to think about it effectively. Okay, story map. I love story maps. I can't get enough of story maps. Everything I do, I start with a story map. I don't think there's a wrong way to approach this. I think there is a way to start. And that way to start is however you think about it more clearly. Because remember, the story map is going to change as you talk to people about it and with it. So I would start maybe with who's the more important user to me. I would start with the person who actually is using the app. The admin side, I would maybe map later and then see what are the similarities? What are the things that they're both doing? And maybe you can kind of combine those into one map. But conceptually, thinking wise, I would probably start with 2 separate maps for the different user personas or different user types. And then as you go through and talk about it more, I think you'll see a lot of overlap and you'll start to kind of put those things together. But I think starting with the other way, and I've done it both ways, I failed both ways, but I've done it both ways where you start with one big massive map for, you know, the 5-6 personas that you have, and it gets too complicated too quick. And then people want to argue about little things. And that's why I would say start with the individual ones, map that, and then kind of see where you're going from there. Jana, any experience with doing something like that?
Yeah, Corey, I think you absolutely nailed it. You know, use them to the degree that you need to. Keep in mind that it's a way of thinking about things and use it to the point that it helps. Don't feel tied down to the structure. My gut is to start with two separate ones and start with the simplest flows first and just get used to the process and build it out from there. Without knowing too much about your app or your flows, I would think that you'd have your end user and your admin user as two separate flows, but you might have various areas that sort of overlap. So, you know, user story maps kind of force you to think in 2D, but in reality, you're actually thinking kind of 3D, but we're not going to make you do that on a whiteboard. You can't. So.
Yep. And it's also one of the biggest problems I see with people starting story maps is they think it's got to be perfect, or they think it's got to be right, or they think it's got to be accurate. Directionally accurate, sure. Informative, yes. It's going to change. Let it be bad first. I mean, just put up something, you know, I know this is wrong, but let's talk about it. Let's walk through it and help me change it. Be open to that type of feedback or be open to that type of change. And expect this to be iterated on multiple, multiple times, many, many times. If you're just first coming out with it initially, yeah, it's going to change a lot, especially once the team and the customers start having input and feedback onto it. So
that reminds me a little bit of that quote, all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Very much so. So again, story maps, love story maps. I've been writing a lot about and teaching a lot about story maps lately in my other work. So
very cool.
It's really good. So hope that helps. All right. Jana Basto, thank you very much for joining. She's at Simply Basto on Twitter and simplybasto.com. You can find all the links to her Mind the Product and ProdPad information. Any other things you want to let folks know about?
No, that sounds good. Hit me up on Twitter, Simply Basto. I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. Feel free to connect with me. If you got any questions, then come find me. It'd be good to chat with you all.
Very good. Thank you very much, Jana.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
And don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaichu.com. All the opinions expressed here are mine. You can find more of them at Is Corey Bryant on Twitter. That is episode 120 delivered. Go out and know the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.